Thank you very much. First of all, I want to thank Rabbi Karsh for the unbelievable exaggerations that, after which I can hardly wait to hear myself speak. And I did notice, being in the audience, actually no one was sleeping at all. Despite having gotten up very early this morning, fantastic, awesome lecture. Thank you very much. So Pesach is coming. So a few things happened in Pesach. First of all, we got out of Egypt. So I'm going to talk about going back to Egypt and Cairo. Jews were in Cairo. But secondly, one of the things we do is we clean out the house. We try to get rid of all the old stuff. So all these sheets of words of Torah, you're not supposed to throw them out. So there are what they call Seamus collection. Seamus is not referring to an Irish guy who collects things from you, but I refer to putting stuff in a place where it's going to be buried and disposed of correctly. So hence that's the tenuous connection to Passover. In Cairo. Jews lived in Cairo for thousands of years. Here's the Ben Ezra Synagogue, which was first built in 822 and then rebuilt in 1025. That's actually how it looks today. It's been renovated. So 1025, Jews had this synagogue in Cairo, living under an Islamic dynasty. And the Jews in Cairo lived, although we were dima, meaning we had certain restrictions and rules regarding our status under the Muslim country, under the Muslim rulers. But nevertheless, we lived reasonably well in Cairo. And for 1,000 years, Jews in Cairo, that's the inside of the synagogue. So for about 1,000 years, Jews in Cairo are depositing stuff, anything written in Hebrew characters, they are putting into a Seamus, meaning a place. Here it is. It's a little. There's a little hole there under the ceiling where you can climb in there. There's a room about half the size of this room and a very, very low where the Jews in Cairo. You see a picture of them actually taking stuff out, but I could have said they're putting stuff in, but that would be a lie. They're actually taking stuff out. Now, although halachically speaking, according to Jewish law, you really only have to dispose of things which have got words of Torah or the name of God, but for our, thank God, the Jews of Cairo were really serious about this. And anything written in Hebrew letters, they would dump there for 1,000 years. There's a book about it. There's many books about it. One of the books is called Sacred Trash. Great title. It's not the best book about it, but it's good. But it's a great title, sacred, because this was trash, but it was sacred because it's in Hebrew characters. Now, as you probably know, the Jews at that time, most Jews wrote in Arabic, Judeo-Arabic. That is to say, Arabic in Hebrew letters. Maimonides wrote most of his books in Arabic in Hebrew letters. We'll see some of his stuff. And they put it all in the Cairo Geniza. In this Geniza, which literally means a hideaway, in the synagogue. Now, what happened to the stuff? It was sitting there for a while. There were a few people who knew there was stuff there. Solomon Aaron Wertheimer published some books based on works from the Cairo Geniza and sold some. There was another, Reb Yaakov Safir, great traveler and also publisher. So he crawled in there. He actually writes, I removed a few folios of some old books and manuscripts, but did not find any valuable information in them. Who knows what lies beneath? Prophetic words. He was living in the 1800s, 19th century, and he says, who knows what lies beneath? So it took this fellow, Shneur Zalman Schechter, who later changed his name to Solomon Schechter, grew up in a Hasidic family in Europe, went to Cambridge University and became a reader, lecturer in Talmud and Hebrew. So Solomon Schechter was the one who really brought to light a lot of the stuff in the Geniza. Now Solomon Schechter was embroiled in a huge argument with a professor at Oxford by the name of David Margoliath. They hated each other with a passion for three reasons. A, and this is probably the main reason, one was in Oxford, one was in Cambridge. Number two, David Margoliath was a Jew who had become a Christian. He was an apostate. Solomon Schechter, although he had dropped his Hasidic upbringing, but he was a traditional Jew in many, many ways. And so that was the second reason. And third, they had an argument about a book known as Ecclesiasticus, Ben Sira. David Margoliath of Oxford, he believed it was a Christian work that had been stolen by the Jews and claimed as their own. Schechter felt it was a Jewish work stolen by the Christians and claimed as their own. Problem was, all the earliest copies of Ben Sira were in Latin and Greek. Ain't nothing in Hebrew. So therefore, Margoliath had a solid leg to stand on. So enter into the scene Agnes Lewis and Margaret Gibson. They were sisters, Scottish Presbyterians, who were friendly with Solomon Schechter. And they were avid travellers, great linguists and archaeologists. They discovered the oldest palimpsest of the New Testament in Sinai. And they said to Solomon Schechter, "We're going to Cairo. So can we pick you up some souvenirs? You know, like bobblehead Moses or snow dome pyramids." That'd be ironic. But anyway, they said, "Can we pick you up some souvenirs?" So he said, "Yeah, that'd be awesome." So they're in Cairo. And they thought there was someone selling manuscripts. Someone from the Jewish community there selling manuscripts from his synagogue trash. And they said, "Okay, this will be a perfect present, perfect souvenir." So the manuscript they end up buying ended up being the oldest manuscript of Ben Sira, and guess what language it was in? Hebrew, blowing Margoliath out of the water. But much more important than blowing Margoliath out of the water was that Solomon Schechter got the idea that, wow, there's good stuff there. Right? There might be some good stuff there, some scholarly work. So he said, "Wow, I've got to go there." Now, of course, Solomon Schechter was, he was as poor as a church mouse. That's actually a bad analogy. But he was not very, he didn't have a lot of money. So, but he needed to get there. So enter into the scene another Christian friend of his, Sam Taylor, who was also a professor at Cambridge, but he had money. And he said he'd finance the trip by Solomon Schechter to Cairo. This is Solomon Schechter's letter to the sisters. He said, "Dear Mrs. Lewis, I think we have reason to congratulate ourselves. The fragment I brought with me represents a piece of the original Hebrew." He underlined it himself. "It is the first time such a thing has been discovered. Please not speak yet about the matter till tomorrow. I will come to you tomorrow at 11 p.m. and talk over the matter with you to make the matter known in haste and great excitement, Schechter." So he's got this meeting with a Scottish Presbyterian at 11 o'clock at night, right? And he realizes some amazing stuff is there. So Taylor comes onto the scene and finances a trip by Schechter to Cairo and gives him money to buy stuff and bring it back to the university. This is a postcard from Solomon Schechter from Cairo in Hebrew. Right? And just a little translation. Do I have the translation? Oh, there we go. Yeah. "My dear, good, honored friend, greetings to you and your dear wife and family. There's no kosher hotel here." Shocking. Right? "I am sick of the local food." Also shocking. Right? "I am busy with my mission almost all day. Please, God, I'll be successful. Please tell me, what's the cost of a Vilna Shas on excellent paper? Can you purchase it? What's the cost of sending us in Egypt?" You cannot be. A Jewish scholar cannot be without the Talmud. Right, and he didn't have an iPad, right? So he's asking, "What's it?" So here is Dr. Schechter in London. That's his friend Charles Taylor who financed it. And basically, Schechter goes to Cairo, suffers terribly. A, no kosher hotel, but B, also he was breathing in the dust and the mold and the manuscripts from 1,000 years of Jewish history. And what he ended up doing was buying lots of it. He had to have some special arrangement. The rabbi, he bought a whole bunch. How many manuscripts did he end up buying? Approximately 300,000 manuscripts. 300, well, I wouldn't say manuscripts, that's a little generous. 300,000 fragments of paper from the... Now, the Cairo synagogue was quite happy. I mean, if someone came to the rabbi here and said, "Listen, we'll take your trash away for a few thousand dollars." He says, "I have to pay you a few thousand..." No, we'll pay you. He was like, "What, seriously?" Right? So they did this, but they dug up. They had stuff buried in the courtyard, in the garden of the synagogue. There was stuff in other places. Other people also bought it, but most of it ended up in Cambridge University. There you see Solomon Schechter breathing in the dust, breathing in the mold, surrounded by approximately 300,000 pieces of paper that really he thought, "Wow, there's got to be a treasure trove here." Of course, it became problematic because one person, with only his eyes and without the aid of all types of technology, is going to have a hard time figuring out who wrote what, etc. So eventually, Cambridge University moved this to what's called the Taylor Schechter Gnisser Research Unit at the Cambridge University Library. It rolls off the tongue, right? And so there in the new library, they moved it, and over the past many years, at least 50 years, they've been working on it slowly and steadily and producing volumes, not the past 100 years of this. So you go up there today, of course the Gnisa documents are kept in a special compartment in the basement, together with things like written by people like Newton and Shakespeare and stuff like that, right? And then they bring it up for research. Now obviously, if you've got a piece of stuff, something like this, which has been sitting, a Tanakh, Torah, prophets and writings, sitting there for 1,000 years, you can't just say, oh, let's look at this, and open it up. It will fall to pieces. So the first part of what you have to do is restoration photography. So, you know, you could do ultraviolet images, which actually reveals a lot more than you can see with the regular eye. So they photograph everything, they scan everything. In addition, you have to actually do the physical restoration. So they have people, you know, sitting there almost certainly in a basement. This is the type of thing that has to be done in a basement. I don't know why. I just get the feeling that when you're restoring this type of thing, it has to be underground, right? It cannot be in a brightly lit office with nice air conditioning, right? You've got to be suffering underground, right? And come back with arthritis after. It's like the whole thing, breathe the glue. It's like the whole works. Anyway, but that's what they do. And they are trying to piece it together. Now, obviously, we have OCR, optical character recognition, which helps tremendously because now you can actually, the computer can actually say, oh, that's the same handwriting. And then you can start putting them together like this huge jigsaw puzzle. Once the physical restoration is complete, it has to be brought upstairs. And then scholars look through it and do analysis and research of this. Is Amir Ashur. At the time, he was the only Jew working there. The rest of the people working there, all non-Jews. The curator, not Jewish, but fluent in Hebrew, Aramaic. One of them was able to read the Torah with the tunes. I was very impressed, right? And Amir Ashur from Tel Aviv University did his doctoral thesis on prenuptial agreements in the Cairo Gnisa. Right, that's a little focused, right? But there's actually a couple of hundred prenuptial agreements in the Cairo. We'll talk about them. It's pretty wild. Anyway, so that's a friend of mine and I from England. So there's I actually arranged for my teacher, our teacher, Rabbi Kash, and I, our teacher, Rav Moshe Shapiro. There's Ben Althwaite, curator. That's an anonymous Jew. And there is Rav Moshe Shapiro. So anyway, let's look at some of the stuff in the Gnisa. Now, I should point out, the Gnisa, first of all, was thought to be important by scholars because of manuscripts of original works of great scholars like Maimonides, Yehuda Halevi, etc. Later, there was a scholar in Princeton called Shondov Goitien who realized that it wasn't just the scholarship that was interesting, but was also interesting was the life, the daily life of Jews in Cairo, and indeed in the entire Mediterranean. Cairo was a crossroad. A lot of people. It was a big trading area. It was a wealthy and influential community. So it also, a receipt would reveal as much as a manuscript of Maimonides. So it wasn't only about the scholarship. It was also about daily life. So we could glean a tremendous amount of information from this sacred trash. So here is a very old Tanakh. Torah, Prophets, and Writings. Actually, the last page, always good to find the last page, because the last page has got what's called a colophon. Colophon is where the person who wrote this says, I wrote this, gives his name, when he completed it, and where he was. So, yeah, that's type of awesome, right? You find the last page, you've got all the information. It's not rocket science anymore. And so this is written by a fellow called Yosef ben Nimored, who finished it in 1215 in Gurbad Imalgan, which is modern-day Dugambadan, which is in Iran, no doubt targeted by Israel. And I think there's a reactor there. Anyway, this is actually what's interesting about this Tanakh, and it probably might be hard to see it, but you see the nekudot, the dots and dashes that provide us with the vowelization of the Hebrew, are all on top of the words. Right? I know that when we write Hebrew, where are our dots and dashes? Like all over the place, right? Top, inside, right, underneath, etc. I still remember from kindergarten, Mrs. Zindel teaching me in Bialik College in Melbourne, Australia, Bet Sefer Chaim Nachman Bialik. She'd say, ooh, oh, right? The dot there is ooh, oh, right? So right? I hope that wasn't on camera, right? So anyway, but basically, but of course then, all the vowels, for some reason, were on top of the words, which we'd probably find puzzling, but that was the standard way it was written. And this, of course, dates back to 1215. So it's not bad. An 800-year-old copy of the Torah, Prophets, and Writings is quite impressive. But it gets better. This goes back over 1,000 to about 1,000 years. This is a letter written by Rav Hushiel ben Elchanan. Rav Hushiel was a Gaon. What is a Gaon? Gaon was the official title of the Rosh Yeshivas, the heads of the yeshivas in Babylon, in a place called Sura and Pumpedita. So the head of these academies, also in Israel there are academies, the heads of the academies are called Gaon, or Gaon Yaakov was the official title, Gaon in short. So there is actually a legend about a number of these Rosh heads of these yeshivas were on a ship in the Mediterranean and were captured by some Islamic pirates. And they were ransomed off to Jewish communities around the shores of the Mediterranean, to Kairouan, Tunisia, Alexandria in Egypt, and to Spain and to France. And there, you know, it's interesting. One of the Gaonim, one of these rabbis who is in the legend, is Rav Hushiel, who is apparently in Kairouan, Tunisia. And here is a letter from Rav Hushiel to family of his in Alexandria. The only problem is that it sounds from the letter that he was voluntarily in Tunisia. It wasn't like captured by pirates or anything. But what is interesting is that the Torah spread either by piracy or by immigration from being concentrated in Babylon and less so in Israel, and it spread now to the shores of the Mediterranean. And of course, as we know, the shores of the Mediterranean were some of the most fertile grounds for Torah knowledge. Just look at France and what it produced, Rashi and the authors of Tosfot, and so on and so forth. And you've got Rashi, of course, is believed to be a student of some. He was in Worms in Germany, but a student possibly of some of the last of the Gaonim. And you've got rabbis in Kairouan and in Tunisia and in Morocco and all these places, which grew out of the spread of Torah from Babylon. So this is a letter from Rav Hushiel. Here is a letter. This is actually interesting. This is the oldest Shabbat song that we sing at the table is, anyone know? The oldest Zmira is Dror Yikra. Dror Yikra, which was written by a man called Dunash ibn Lebret. Dunash had been a student of Sa'ad Jagon. Sa'ad Jagon was trying to encourage people to write Hebrew poetry. The Arabs had a thing called Al Arabiya, which is the idea that Arabic is the greatest language. So the Jews took up the challenge to show that no, it's not. Hebrew can do its own as well. So one of the first books Rav Sa'ad Jagon wrote was actually a rhyming dictionary of Hebrew to help people write poetry in Hebrew. So Dunash wrote a beautiful poem called called Dror Yikra, which we sing at the Shabbat table. Dunash left Spain suddenly, and he left his wife and child there. We're not sure exactly why, but either persecution or we don't exactly know why. But when he left, he went to Cairo, and there is actually a poem, a letter that his wife wrote to him. It's the only example we have of a poem from a medieval woman, Jewish woman. That's it. This is it. And it's a very beautiful poem, right? Hayizkor ya'alat chen yedida, will her love remember his graceful doe? Beyond Pirud u'bizra yechida, her only son in her arms as they parted. V'samchoten yiminah smalah, he placed his ring from his right hand on her left, ubizra'ah, and on his hand, halosamat smidah, she placed her bracelet. Just keep in mind, the bracelet usually was how you converted your dowry into something that you could take with you and could be what. So it was an expense. So they didn't part on bad terms. He gives her his ring. She gives her the bracelet with a lot of money, was invested in that bracelet, and economics of this is beyond the scope of this lecture, but she was concerned about him, and he left. And then it says, beyond lakal zikaron didosh, she took his mantle, his cloak, as a keepsake, v'hulakach zikaron didosh, and he took her cloak as his keepsake. Right, hayishaer b'chol eretz Sfarad, would he remain in the land of Spain, v'lulaka chetzi malchut b'yada, if he'd even given half the kingdom, will he stay? Very sad poem, and it's in the Cairo Gniza, and there is the actual, well, that's part of the original, and it's from the wife of Dunash ibn Lebret, author, composer of the beautiful song Dror Yikra. So that's 10th century, again, about 1,000 years ago. Here is a copy of a letter to Chasdai ibn Shafrut. Chasdai ibn Shafrut was a Jew who was a diplomat who worked for the Muslim rulers of Spain, and this is a copy of a letter from a Khazar Jew, describing the conversion of the Khazars to Judaism. The Khazars were a group of apparently pagans who sometime in what's called now, I think, Eastern Ukraine, and who from about the 9th century onwards began to be known as Jews. Those Christians call them Jews, the Muslims call them Jews, the Jews call them Jews, they call themselves Jews, they're probably Jews, right? So what happened is, we're not sure, but the most famous book about them is the Kitab al-Khazari, the book by Yehuda Halevi, that describing how the king of the Khazars kept having a recurrent dream that he needed to get his actions in line with his intentions. And he gets a philosopher and a Christian and a Muslim. He argues with them. He doesn't like any of them. A Jew comes and talks to him. He's obviously the most persistent. And eventually the king and his people convert to Judaism as a result of this. And the book Khazar, the Khazari, is designed based on that dialogue. It's highly unlikely that he actually had a transcript of the dialogue, but it's loosely based on what Yehuda Halevi would have imagined took place. And it's fascinating. We have actually some correspondence from the Khazars to the Jews. This is one of them, a letter to Chasda ibn Shafrut from the Khazars, 10th, 11th century, on paper. This is a prenuptial agreement. The most common prenupt agreement in the Cairo Geniza was that the husband can only, a few things. A, the husband can only go on business trips with the permission of his wife. Yeah, what do you think? That's a good idea, right? So the business trips then were not like 2 days in Vegas for a convention, right? Business trips then was like months, and you never know when they came back. There are those who say that the decree against polygamy by Rabbeinu Gershom was because there were Jewish men who had second families in places where they went for business, and so their wife be left behind. So he made a very serious ban of excommunication on polygamy, and that may have been one. The second most common condition in the prenups was no female slaves. Everyone had slaves back then. No female slaves for obvious reasons. Right, this is the wife would impose this and say, you know, no female slaves. And this is an unusual, slightly unusual prenup. This is a guy by the name of Kibalti Alai Ani Tuvia. I accepted upon myself, and the guy's name is Tuvia. What did he accept upon himself? Right? He says, I will not bring into my house licentious men, buffoons, frivolous jesters, and good-for-nothings. His friends. I will not enter into the house of anyone who clings to licentiousness, corruption, and ugly deeds. I will not associate with them for food or drink or anything else. I will not purchase for myself a slave girl as long as Faiza is with me. So his wife said, you want to marry me? You sign this, buddy. Right? That means he obviously did not have a great reputation, as you can see, but he obviously wanted to marry this woman, and he's prepared to say, I'm giving up my friends. I will not go to the pool room. I will not go to the bar. They will not come to the house to watch the Super Bowl or whatever the equivalent was in Egypt, right? And if he does, there's severe financial penalties involved in this. And of course, the standard clause, which is no slave girl. Okay, understandable. What's also interesting about this particular prenup is the date. You look at the date: Rosh Chodesh Kislev, standard, first day of the month of Kislev. Right, Shnat Shalot, Elish Shosmot, etc. The year 1359, Kaminyan, Sha'anu Regilin Linot Po Befostat, according to that which we are not accustomed to count here in Fostat. Fostat was a neighborhood of Cairo, and that's where a lot of the Jews lived. And in Fostat, Mitzrayim, Egypt, Sha'al Nilus Hanahar on the Nile River. Very standard. What's not standard is the date, 1359. Now, no Jew is writing a contract based on the year of their Lord, right? Anno Domini, right? Our Lord, right? So it doesn't. They're not. So 1359. The Jewish date from creation, 1359, is before the birth of Abraham, right? Abraham was born in 1948 from creation. So 1359 makes no sense unless you are aware of the fact that the Jews were very grateful to Alexander of Macedon, who invaded Israel but did not destroy the temple. So what did we do? The most famous thing you're probably aware of is we started giving Alexander as a Jewish name. But secondly, which is not as famous, but it's explicit in the Talmud, is we started counting our documents from the beginning of the reign of Alexander. It's called Minyan Shtarot, the counting of documents, and we find and if you make the calculation, 1359 is 1359 according to the from the reign of Alexander, which is a fulfillment of the rabbinic law, which is mentioned in the Talmud in Avodah Zarah, tractate Avodah Zarah. So it's fascinating the Jews were keeping this. This was kept until David ben Zimra, the chief rabbi of Egypt in the 16th century, said, we're going back to enough already with Alexander. We're grateful enough. We're going back to the time of creation. If you look at your own ketuvah, it's not dated from Alexander's reign. Right? It's probably dated from creation, right? Almost certainly. Okay, so that's the date. Here is also another fragment of a ketuvah, a marriage contract dated from the reign of Alexander. As you can see, it's written nicely. A lot of people, even though ketuvah is like it's a legal contract, but people, you know, even today, people like to make it decorative and beautiful. And I mean, if you read what it says in it, it's really it's like a heavy legal contract. It's like with talks about predeceasing and divorce and mortgages and liens on property and stuff like that. And you're like, so framing it just like seems a little strange, but people do this because of romance, right? You've heard of the concept, right? And so they did this also in Egypt. And here is, here in 1048, we're still 1,000 years ago, this is a letter from Ramla in Israel describing an earthquake that took place there. As written to the Jews of Egypt, there was a community of Palestinian Jews in Egypt. There were local Jews, there were Palestinian Jews, there were Karaites, and the Karaites were people who rejected the oral law. Rabbi Karsh mentioned the predecessors of the Karaites, the Sadducees beforehand. And so the Jews of Palestine, of Ramla, describing an earthquake that took place to their fellow Palestinian Jews who now lived in Cairo. It's very interesting. There is actually a fault line. It's called the Syrian-African Rift Line. Runs through Israel. It's something like the San Andreas Fault of Israel, right? It's according to the United Nations, everything's the fault of Israel. But this this indeed is Israel's fault. And so there have been earthquakes throughout history recorded at various times. And this is a description of one of the earthquakes. And this is a ketuvah, which is a very interesting ketuvah. Here it's an intermarriage, but it's a weird intermarriage. It's an intermarriage between a rabbinic Jew and a Karaite woman. Rabbinic, a man who believed in the oral tradition, rabbinic, and the Karaites who rejected it all. So, but they got married. Now, it's a difficult marriage. Why is it a difficult marriage? Because the Karaites calculated the festivals differently. In the Tuba, they specify that each will respect each other's festivals. So you're going to have two Pesachs, right? Or, you know, you're going to have different calculations. And she has to sit in the dark, because Karaites did not believe in, they read the Torah, what they claim to be literally, don't have a fire in your house on Shabbat. So they blow out the candles, sit in the dark, eat cold food. But the rest of us, we light candles, we have the heater on, and we have cholent, right? Or chamin, or orissa, or schina, or whatever it is. So here, he agrees that his wife is allowed to sit in a dark room over Shabbat. I mean, she's, right? And they have the respect, but it's fascinating. And here it's signed both by rabbinite rabbis and Karaite scholars. You can tell the Karaites use Ben, which is Hebrew, and so-and-so, son of so-and-so, and the rabbinite scholars use Ibn, right? Bar, which is Aramaic, which is the language of the Talmud. And they write afterwards Samach Tetz, which people think is Sephardi Tahor, pure Sephardi. It's actually not, because they did not look at themselves as Sephardim because they were not from Spain. Why would they call themselves Sephardim? They had no connection to Spain at that time. So, they call it Sofot. It's actually a blessing. It's like Sofotov, may his end be good. It's like a little blessing you write after your name. Here is one of the most beautiful finds from Maimonides. Maimonides, one of the greatest Jewish scholars ever. So Maimonides, Rambam, this is a page from his commentary on the Mishnah, and in his own handwriting. And we have hundreds of pages of Maimonides' commentary on the Mishnah and other works of Maimonides that were found in the Cairo Gniza. They've been published. It's been used to produce the Mosada Rav Kook edition of the commentary on the Mishnah. The Rambam's and the Mishnah, his commentary on the Mishnah was written in Arabic, Judeo-Arabic, meaning Arabic in Hebrew letters, with lots of Hebrew mixed in. And you have his own diagrams. The most famous diagram, of course, of the Rambam is his diagram of the menorah, which is actually all types of problems with it, but we're not going to go into that now. But here's a letter from Maimonides. So this is a letter of recommendation to a guy called Yitzhak al-Dari. Yitzhak al-Dari is a scholar. It looks like he may have been a relative of Maimonides, and he's asking for a recommendation for Maimonides to say that he is indeed a Torah scholar. Why does he need this? Because, as you know, under Islamic rule, the one most consistent component of the Dhimma regulations was that Jews and Christians have to pay jizya, which is tribute to the Muslims. That was consistent across the board. Things varied up and down, because we're talking about a vast amount of history and many different countries. One thing always was jizya, for two reasons. A, money. Right? And B, it's explicit in the Quran, as opposed to the other ones, which are from the Hadith. But leaving that aside, so a lot of communities, the rabbinical scholars, the community would pay their tax for them. Great idea. No, it's a good, So rabbinical scholars would get the taxes by the community paid for them. So obviously you walk into a community and say, I'm a scholar, pay my taxes. People, what do you think people are going to say? Yeah, right, buddy. Right, so am I, yeah? So no, but if you've got a letter from Maimonides, Maimonides says I'm a scholar, that's it, you're done. So this is a letter of recommendation from Maimonides. Can anyone read the top here? Can anyone read those two words? It's in Hebrew letters, but it's Arabic. How do you think? Anyone write when you write a letter? What do you write at the top? Some people do this. You don't have to. But Baruch Hashem. So the Rambam did the same thing. Inshallah. Inshallah. Right, by the will of Allah, of God. It's Arabic. Right, because the Rambam was writing in Arabic. That's what the Jews spoke. So the beginning, it's always weird. People look at this and they're looking at the Rambam. It's Arabic. I said, well, duh, the Rambam spoke Arabic. He didn't speak Yiddish, right? So,
did he spell out God's name?
Yeah. Yes, he did. Now, this is the end of the letter, which is, I've just enlarged it so you can actually see his signature. And he ends it with a blessing in Hebrew. Shlom ha-yirbeh, may her peace increase, the community. Shlom ha-chaver u-beno, the peace of the friend and his son. Moshe ben Rav Maimon Zatzal, Moses, son of Rabbi Maimon of blessed memory. His father's name was Maimon. Teachers sometimes say there's no such thing as a stupid question. Not true. There are stupid questions. I've had many of them. So one student asked me, well, how could he write a blessed memory after his own name? I said, hello, right? It's his father, Ben Rav Maimon. His father is blessed memory. He's not writing about himself. Okay, but anyway, that's the Rambam signature. That's the letter. That's in a special folder, which is a special type of plastic, which is actually allows air in, and it's a special type of plastic that doesn't cause the manuscript to deteriorate. I don't know what's in it or not in it, but it's interesting. The guy there said, would you like to touch the letter? Put your finger in and touch the letter. I said, well, why would I want to do that? He says, I don't know, a lot of Jews come here, they say they want to touch the letter. I said, Maimonides would think I'm an idiot for wanting to touch the letter. It's Maimonides' letter. The last person would say, oh, if you touch this letter, it's amazing, right? It would be Maimonides. There's no way. So, it was cool enough to hold it, which I did for coolness, not for schooler. Right, anyway, this is a section, autograph section of Maimonides' Mishneh Torah, his code of law, which was actually written in Hebrew. And what's great is when you study it, in the yeshiva, when we study the Rambam Mishneh Torah, we dwell on every word and letter. Why is it in this order? Why is the title used? Why is it? Because there's a huge amount of scholarship on this. But we know that the Rambam took extreme, extreme care in writing this. You can see, and in the manuscript, things he crossed out, things he rewrote. So what's wonderful is you can see a little bit of his thought process. Okay, and you can even see, like here is, for example, he, in the title of this section, he originally wrote Hilchot Nezikin, which means laws of damages. He crossed out Nezikin and he rewrote Hilchot Nizkei Mamon, laws of damage by property. In other words, it's too general, laws of damage. This is damage by your property. So here, it actually, look at this. I mean, some librarian, some fanatical, stamped in the middle of a close to 900-year-old document written by Maimonides in his handwriting, they stamped library. I mean, if they ever bring back capital punishment in England, right? I mean, seriously, this whoever got this, right? Anyway, but you can actually read Maimonides' writing here. He says, "Kol nefesh chaya, any living being, shibishuto shel adam shizika, which is in a person's property that caused damage." Habalim chayavim l'shalem. The owners are obligated to pay. This is the same as we have in our manuscript. Of course, he crossed out something here, and he quotes the verse Shene'emar. So it's like it's wonderful. You can see this is the Maimonides, one of our greatest scholars in his writing. This is actually a manuscript of the Guide for the Perplexed, which was again Judaic, back to Arabic, but in Hebrew. Although you can sometimes, like here, I've just outlined where he quotes a verse in the Torah. Can anyone read that? Vayishkon Kavod Hashem al Har Sinai, the honor of God rests on Mount Sinai. Now he's abbreviated God's name with a yud and a yud, and a little chick chick on top, like yud yud abbreviation mark. Why yud yud? Right, this is actually an old form of abbreviation of God's name, but you see, when you see God's name written in the Torah, it's written yud, hey, and vav and hey. We don't ever pronounce that. We pronounce it actually Adonai. So, but the abbreviation contains the first letter of the way it's written, yud, and the last letter of the way it's pronounced, yud. So yud yud is God's name as it's written and as it's read. That's why the traditional abbreviation is that way, and that's how Maimonides himself does it. And now we have one of the coolest things I saw, which is Maimonides' squiggle. See that? The squiggle of Maimonides. Because what happens? Look at the letters. He's running out of ink. He must have dipped the pen in and then done some squiggles, and now here it's much bolder. I don't know why, but I find this one of the most touching things I saw, because you know, here at Maimonides, we was superhuman in what he produced. The amount of scholarship, the depth of the scholarship, the impact he had on the Jewish world, on the secular world, on the whole world was unbelievable. But his pen also ran out of ink. Like he was not sitting there with a line of people with pens waiting for him. Right? He was earning a living as a physician. He was, you know, I mean, for a while he was supported by his brother. We'll talk about that. But his pen ran out of ink. You know, like it's amazing. So one similarity between me and Maimonides. My pen has also ran out of ink. Here's a second similarity. This is someone who visited Maimonides with his son. This man came bringing a message from a court asking for Maimonides' opinion about something. This guy was not even he was not on the court. He was just a messenger, like the FedEx type guy, right? And he came to give, and Maimonides, first of all, he describes in the letter, this man describes how Maimonides had his son Avraham take his son and play with him in the room, but he wanted him not to be out of the room because he wanted to see the Rambam, who already at that time was famous. And he says the Rambam discussed with this man who really was not a scholar, but the Rambam wanted to make him feel good. He didn't just want to say, "Yeah, give me it and let me look through it." He actually discussed with him his opinion of the court's ruling and then handed it back. And of course, he says how the Rambam brought out, "I kissed his noble hand. He received us with the most cordial welcome. What transpired there, which a book would prove insufficient to describe." He was just so impressed because Maimonides was treating him like a colleague, even though he was just the messenger. And he writes, "And caskets were brought, and he began to eat lemon cakes." So I also like lemon cakes. There's second similarity, right? So now here is a mezuzah, which is no good. This is an invalid mezuzah. Why? Because it's got additions to it. The mezuzah is supposed to have shema. But some people thought, Maimonides writes, some fools thought that if you write the names of angels on it, it'll make it even better. Put in a few Magen Davids, even better, right? He says these fools have turned a mitzvah of God, a mitzvah of the Torah, into a, what does he call it? A talisman for their own benefit. It's not a good luck charm. It's a mezuzah. It has legal criteria, right? You have to write the Shema. It has to be written this. Adding more. Oh, let's put in more Jewish stuff. That makes it even better, right? Put in some Chernikovsky and we'll put in some dry bone cartoon and it'll be unbelievable, right? No, it doesn't work that way. And indeed, this is one from the Gnizah. This is a letter from his brother, David. We know that David, the brother of Maimonides, supported him for many years. He was a merchant. He drowned tragically in a sinking of a ship on the way to the Indian Ocean. And Maimonides writes it's one of the greatest tragedy that ever occurred. He actually writes he was so depressed he could barely get out of bed for close to a year afterwards. Suffered from severe depression after the death of his brother. And every time he'd ever see something written in his brother's handwriting, he'd burst into tears. And it was after his brother passed away, Maimonides now had to take the burden of his own family's income and his brother's family, and that's when he became physician to Salah al-Din, Saladin, who was the vizier of Sultan of Egypt. But this is the last letter his brother David. By the way, there are those who say that one of the reasons Maimonides, the number 14 comes up in a lot of Maimonides' works, 14 volumes of the Mishneh Torah, 14 roots in the Book of the Commandments, 14 chapters in one of his books on logic, is a tribute to his brother David. David, numerical value of David, 14. Dalad, Dalad, 4, 4, and 6. So it was a tribute to David. But there's no confirmation of that, but it's very possible. So here is this last letter from David, who took off from... took off, I'm thinking of my plane. Right, but he went from Adab, a port in Sudan. He travelled from Cairo down south, the ship went down somewhere in the Gulf of Aden. Maimonides writes, "The greatest misfortune that has befallen me during my entire life, worse than anything else, was the demise of the saint, may his memory be blessed, who drowned in the Indian Sea." And here is the letter in which he writes to my beloved brother David and Maimon, and he writes how he travelled out through the desert. The camel caravan was attacked. He had to go separately. He barely survived the desert. He prays at the end that God who saved him from the desert will save him from the sea. Unfortunately, that prayer was not answered positively. And at the end, he writes, "Don't worry. Please calm the heart of the little one and her sister," meaning his sister and her sister-in-law, Maimonides' wife. And that's the last letter we have from David to Maimonides. This is a responsum of Avraham, son of Maimonides, who was, you know, he's got to be rough being the son of the Rambam. Serious, you know what I mean? Right, but, and it's interesting, he was a great scholar and leader in his own right, who actually took off in a little bit of a different direction. He got more involved in mysticism and meditation. The Rambam, very much not into that, but his son, very much into that. So it's interesting, he had his own path, which is fine. Here we have one of the oldest. It's a piyut. We have a lot of piyut. A piyut means literally sounds like poet, right? Poem, but it's a liturgical poem. Many of them found in the Cairo Geniza. This one is actually written by a convert to Judaism by the name of Ovadia, who was born in Italy around 1070, converted to Judaism, which of course is suicidal in Catholic Italy in the 11th century. So he had to leave and he went to Aleppo in Syria. From there, he went to Cairo and he settled in Cairo. And he changed his name to Ovadia. That was a common name for converts because Ovadia himself, the prophet Ovadia, was indeed a convert from the nation of Edom. And he wrote a beautiful song about Moses, Mi'al Har Horev. What's even more beautiful about it is that what was found in the Geniza was the musical notes and the lyrics of the song. So we actually now are able to hear the music that the Jews in Cairo may have been listening to, reconstructed by some Israeli musicians. It's a 2-minute clip, which hopefully will work. So I thought it stopped. Okay. Thank you. So this is probably very likely type of music. So just to give you an idea how intimately we can know stuff about the Jews of Cairo, Solon of Goitian wrote a book called A Mediterranean Society. It's about 9 volumes with unbelievable amount of detail, just all gleaned from the Cairo Geniza. But the music, this by the way, is one of the oldest Yiddish letters we have, was written from somewhere in Europe to somewhere in Cairo, and from a woman called Rochel to her son in Cairo. And as you might expect, what does it say? One of the things it says in the letters is, "Why don't you write?" I mean, seriously, I thought it was a joke when I first read this, but it actually, it's like one of the oldest Yiddish letters we have. She's like, why don't you write? Right? What's going on? Anyway, so this is a letter from Yehuda Halevi, the great Hebrew poet, author of, I just read a poem of his, not as well known as one of his secular poems. It says, I saw a white hare and I plucked it out. The hare said to me, you've defeated me one-on-one. What will you do when I come back with an army? So I can really relate to that poem. So anyway, Yehuda Halevi, this is a letter he wrote regarding a certain halachic issue. He wanted to know if his friend could check with a great rabbi if it was correct. If he'd ruled correctly, that's the address and how it got there with that. This is cool. This is the oldest Hechsher Kashrut certification ever. This is a Kashrut certification from the 11th or 12th century. For cheese, in a cheese store from Cairo, I can never read this without thinking of the Monty Python cheese shop sketch, but those who are familiar, Hamevi Yavin. Anyway, so this is, what it basically says is, B'shimchara, in the name of God, I want to tell the rabbis in Egypt that Yefet, son of Meshulam, who is a Karite, who has brought with him 30 rounds of cheese made on the Mount of Olives or made by the production area in the Mount of Olives. He's brought them to Egypt. I want you to know they are kosher and they are good and they conform to Jewish law. He says he made an oath on the Holy Torah that he would not deviate from my instructions, and we also shook on it so he can be trusted, and it's signed by three rabbis from Cairo. So, you know, we walk around now. You want to know something's kosher? You look for? I have a friend who has a museum of natural history in Israel, biblical history, Natan Slifkin. So he said he had a little kid at the museum. He asked the kid, he says, do you know what the signs of a kosher animal are? And the kid said, oh, yeah. He says, what? The kid says, oh, you. It's like, not what he meant, but okay. But this is OU, or CRC, should be more correct here, right? This is the OU of Cairo on the cheese shop, not including Venezuelan beaver cheese. And this is Kaddish, but it's an old Kaddish. Here it's a Kaddish where they used to include the names of their rabbis in Kaddish as a way of paying tribute to them. Because we say, b'chayechon of yomechon, in your life and in your days. So they would say, in your life and in your days, and in the life of Eviatar, the Rosh Yeshiva, Adonainu Eviatar, our master Eviatar, head of the Yeshiva, Gaon Yaakov, that's the title of the heads of the Yeshiva, as I mentioned before, Chaya Rabbeinu Shlomo HaKohen, Av HaYeshiva, in the life of Shlomo HaKohen. We know the Ramban, Nachmanides, says that the Yemenite Jews would include Maimonides in their Kaddish. They'd say, B'chayechon of Yomechon of Chaya Demarana Moshe, in the life of our master Moses, because he literally saved them psychologically, physically, through his letter. And so that was Kaddish. And of course, for those of us who don't know Sfarad, we'll be happy to see the Yasmach Prukone in the Kaddish, as it should be. This is one of the oldest Haggadahs found. It has two differences from our Haggadah. Number one is, you can see at the top by that large arrow, they have an additional blessing right after Kiddush. They would say, Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Olam Sha'asa Nisim La'avoteinu, B'yamim Haile, you did miracles for our forefathers in these days. So that's something we only say Hanukkah and Purim, but apparently they said it. Then here is the five questions. Manishtana? Yes, I said five questions, right? And because they used to add something which Maimonides says was only added in the time of the temple, but they would ask, on all other nights we eat all types of meat, roasted, fried, boiled, etc. On this night, in the days of the temple, we only ate roasted meat, the Passover offerings. That's the five questions they would have. This is an old 10th century Palestinian version of Birkat HaMazon, the first three paragraphs, very similar to ours, some variations. Going a little faster here, I'm going to skip some things. That's a letter from Kiev to Cairo, signed by Jews. Some of the Jews who signed it had names which are Khazar names. In other words, Jews, people who had converted to Judaism, were now part of the Kiev Jewish community, but were of Khazar origin. And actually, someone's written in the Khazar language, Turkic, not to be confused with Turkish, but Turkic, underneath is written, I have seen it, or I have read this. So that's in Khazar language. And here, the most beautiful thing I saw there were children's textbooks teaching alphabet to the children of Cairo. There are numerous scholarly articles on this. 11th century textbooks teaching alphabet to the kids in Cairo with nice illustrations on them. There's the menorah, of course. And what's even more beautiful are what the kids themselves wrote when they were in class. So these are children from about 800-900 years ago learning Aleph Beit in Cairo, like our children learn. And here, nothing has changed. What's the kid done? Doodles! I'm actually writing a paper now on these doodles and trying to figure out what they are, actually. So, I don't know, to me, what do you think that looks like? It looks like a camel to me, I don't know. I thought it was a camel, stirrups and a smiley face. Hard to know. That looks like some type of menorah. This looks like random stuff. But, you know, the kid's got lousy writing. You know, he didn't do well, right? And he's got the Googles. They used to learn Hebrew writing for 3 months, approximately. At age 6 or 7 is when they'd start studying writing. And they'd learn it. The only reason they learned how to write was in order to learn how to read. They never practiced writing beyond that. We think it's approximately 800 to 900 years old. Not absolutely certain. There's no date. Here is a good kid. Here was the nerdy kid, got beaten up at recess, no doubt. And here is another kid. What's he drawn here? So I was able to determine, using the popular book Medieval Ships of the Mediterranean, world bestseller, that this kid has doodled a Nile river boat. So that's a classic Nile, because you see, he's looking out the window as his teacher is droning on, and what's he seeing? A boat. What's more interesting to a kid? Aleph, Beit, Gimel, or, oh cool, a boat, right? So he doodles a boat, and there next to the boat on the left-hand side is the sun. Yeah, that's the sun, right? So it's very, very cool to see that children have not changed. I showed this in South Africa last summer. I showed it to kids in a school, like the whole elementary school, kindergarten to sixth grade, and I said, anyone do doodles? And they said, yeah. Some people with hands. I said, well, guess what? Right, this may have been the Rumlum's doodle, right? So, he didn't grow up in Cairo; he grew up in Spain. But okay, maybe his son's
might
doodle.
Might not be the Rumlum's doodle because the Rumlum didn't draw a sun on the Lord.
Oh, that may be right. It couldn't have been. He was 16 when he came to Cairo. So anyway, but this is a letter, a business letter of Rabbi Yosef Karo, who was the author of the Code of Jewish Law, that was sent from Sfat to Cairo, demanding the payment of a business expense. And as you can see, it's probably written by a professional scribe, but signed by Rabbi Yosef Karo underneath, author of the Code of Jewish Law. That's the letter as a whole, quite an impressive thing. That is another business letter. Rav Isaac Luria, when his father died, he and his mother moved to Cairo, and he was working for his wealthy uncle in Cairo, who owned an island on the Nile where Isaac Luria used to go and meditate on the Zohar. And when he was in his 30s, he actually moved to Tzfat, as you know, and became the greatest Kabbalist. But here is a business letter from Rav Isaac Luria in Cairo, with his signature, sufficiently cool to be a Kabbalist, as you can see, right? And so that's the end of that's where some of the stuff is. What else is there? There's about 50 unpublished sponsor of Avraham, son of Maimonides. There are students' notes of Maimonides' lectures, which you can imagine would be quite amazing. You know, who would want to sit in Maimonides' class, right, when he's teaching the Talmud or philosophy? Well, we have notes of the children who wrote, or, I don't know, not children, but we have notes of his students, and there are students under Rimi Gashen. That's about it, and of course, that's not in the Cairo Geniza, but that's worthwhile buying. So that's it for today. Have a wonderful Pesach. Thank you very much. Listen, I'll take some questions. Yes.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
At the website, and there's a catalog of the exhibition also.
Right. Okay. Any questions? Yeah.
What's the brocha again in Arabic? Something Allah?
Inshallah.
Inshallah. Inshallah. So if you wrote that on a social letter, would that generate a requirement of Geniza if you added Allah?
Good question. You have to ask your local Orthodox rabbi. Probably probably yes, probably, I'm not sure. But the Jews in Cairo didn't do it for halal. They just, anything in Hebrew, they put in the Geniza, which is great for us, great for me, great for all of us. And thank you for listening.
Thank you.
I used to do
you know, pepper spray.
Oh,
I know. I said the same thing. I want my son-in-law to have it.
We're picking some proportions.
I know. I don't have to learn that music. I shot an M16. I was in the army. I was in the American army for 2 years. So I have to take a relationship.
There's also a child.
Because when they found recently from Tamil Nadu on a wall someplace in menorah that looked like my mother was filled with curves. And I think, like, if I was going to write something with a curve, it's very difficult to draw with a curve without a curve. So my mother is probably he's making a point of something else.
There's hundreds of pages of articles about the menorah. It's fine in the university. And one thing that the Rambam himself writes after that diagram is, I'm only doing this in order to show you the placement of the cups and the balls. I'm not doing this to show you what the menorah actually looks like. So that's the Rambam here. So, you know, so it's hard to take that as a literal description of the menorah, especially since there's not a single archaeological diagram. I mean, maybe one, but it looks like that.
That was 1200.
From Italy. That's how the musicians were able to dig it out.
Still very controversial about letting others into
the people that actually put most of the stuff on the internet. It's available for free. The Freeburg has most of the documents on the internet. There's 1 or 2 universities that are looking at it. It's accessible by anyone. It's really great.
Is it renowned?
Yes.
Thank you.